This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. Michigan State University has a new president.
He was a professor, did a lot of research, kind of came up through the ranks into the administration, and has been in a sitting university president.
Michigan voters think the roads are bad and getting worse, but they're not too keen on giving the state more money to fix them.
There's a lot of hesitancy to give the government extra money or additional money if they aren't sure it's going to be spent where they say it is.
A University of Michigan student is invited to show her short at the Cannes Film Festival.
I wanted to learn about filmmaking, and that was my goal here, but this was just like the cherry on top of everything.
And a 55-year-old experiment with preschool is having a greater effect than expected.
This evidence that we see is across different studies, different communities, different populations, even across the world.
Plus, we'll talk about the latest plan to stop Asian carp from getting to the Great Lakes. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. On today's program, Michiganders agree the roads are bad, they ought to be fixed, but there's little agreement about how to find the money to get it done.
People were concerned that the roads aren't being built very well in the first place, or that the money wouldn't be distributed. So there's a lot of hesitancy to give the government extra money or additional money if they aren't sure it's going to be spent where they say it is.
Later in the hour, what voters think about how we should fix the roads. But first, Michigan State University has a new president. Here to talk about that is David Jesse. He covers higher education for the Detroit Free Press. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me again.
Who is this new MSU president?
So the new president is Dr. Samuel Stanley, who is the current president of Stony Brook University, which is one of the universities in the New York public university system out on Long Island. And he'll start at Michigan State on August 1st.
August 1st, okay. Did the Michigan State Board of Trustees say why they've chosen Stanley?
They said they liked a lot about him. He fit a lot of the traditional characteristics of a university president. He was a professor, did a lot of research, kind of came up through the ranks into the administration, and has been a sitting university president. So he brings a lot of experience, a lot of time in with him in the university. It's not like he's coming in new and has to learn how universities work. He has a strong commitment to research. He has a strong commitment to faculty governance, to diversity, some of the key issues that the board mentioned today.
Yeah, I was reading his bio. It seems pretty impressive to me. I mean, we've got University of Chicago, Harvard, Washington, and St. Louis. You cover higher ed. I don't know that much about it. What do you think of his background?
Like you said, it's very impressive. If you just look at his resume, right? It's, I don't know how you would do much better than that. He's a researcher who has gotten grants from the National Institutes of Health. So he's done work. He'll understand what that's like. He's taught classes, and he's been an administrator. And he comes from well-regarded schools. I mean, it's hard to see anything on his resume that's a knock against him. They certainly appear to have gotten, from an academic side at least, a very strong candidate.
So taking the reins at Michigan State University is a lot different than taking reins at universities have not seen as much controversy. I mean, with the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal, the mishandling of the situation by some top officials at Michigan State, what experience does Stanley bring to deal with such a mess?
That's still a little bit of a question mark. We are reporting today in a story up on freep.com that Stony Brook is under federal investigation looking for at how they handle sexual assault complaints. That's not uncommon in these days. So certainly he knows what that's like and what the system's like. He's been through some of these. There's been some lawsuits filed against Stony Brook. Again, that's a common thing in these, or not uncommon thing in these days. As far as the specifics, he said today in his opening remarks at the board meeting right after he got hired that he wants to sit down and hear from the survivors, that he wants to learn from them. He said they'll never be forgotten, that they'll guide what he is doing when it comes to the safety of students going forward at Michigan State.
And you said he started it on August 1st. I assume he's got some things to wrap up at Stony Brook. So what's it take to make a transition like that?
Well, he's got to learn a lot about the university right here. And then he's also going to be, trying to pass it on. Stony Brook's going to be doing a search. I would assume that he has informed his board before today that he was interested in other jobs or leaving. And so they'll be looking for a president, how much he'll, pass on stuff to him, that next person there or be around. I don't know. here. I know he's already, you know, we're seeing tweets from deans of Michigan State's various colleges that they were meeting with him as soon as today, already today, hours after, you know, he was hired. I know that he is headed tomorrow to Mackinac, to the policy conference, to meet folks up there. So the learning curve, he's going to try to be juggling two hats, you know, keeping Stony Brook going, making a smooth transition there. At the same time, trying to learn as much as he can about Michigan State and what the issues are here.
That is David Jesse. He covers higher ed for the Free Press. We've been talking about Michigan State University's new president, who was named today, Samuel Stanley Jr. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
$778 million. That's how much the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers estimates it will cost to block Asian carp in the Illinois River from reaching Lake Michigan. The Brandon Road Lock and Dam Project is the latest effort in a long history of trying to stop the invasive fish from getting into the Great Lakes. Here to tell us more about that history is David Hamilton. He is Policy Director for the Nature Conservancy's Great Lakes Project. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So there are these four types of Asian carp: the black carp, the grass carp, the big head carp, and the silver carp. That's the one that jumps out of the water, by the way. Each one of these represents a different kind of threat to the Great Lakes. Can you explain what those threats are?
Well, the two ones that get the most attention are the big-headed carp and the silver carp, and those are the ones that are in the Illinois waterway right now. And they are filter feeders, and they can take away, just devastate the base of the food chain. Grass carp, they eat vegetation, and they're in the Lake Erie area. And then black carp, they eat mollusk, and they're working their way up the Mississippi towards the Illinois River.
Now, these are river fish that prefer warmer water, more turbidity or cloudiness. Why do experts think they're a devastating threat to the Great Lakes?
Well, the problem in the Great Lakes is going to be largely in tributaries and Lake Erie. Those are places where these fish would do very well. So it's not so much you're going to have silver carp jumping out of the middle of Lake Michigan, but you could have them on any of the tributaries of Lake Michigan. And then the black carp, they eat mollusks, so they would be probably very happy with Lake Michigan and all the zebra mussels and quagga mussels there.
Which might not be a bad thing. Let's go back in history. There was a barrier built in the canal connecting Lake Michigan to an Illinois River tributary back in 2002. Now, it was built to prevent round goby from getting from Lake Michigan into the Illinois River. That failed spectacularly. Then that barrier was sort of rebranded as an Asian carp barrier when those fish started to populate the Illinois River. How did Asian carp get into the Mississippi River and then the Illinois River to begin with?
Well, Asian carp were brought into the United States from Asia back in probably the 60s, and they were used in some southern states like Arkansas, Alabama, and they're used to control in ponds on farms in aquaculture. And then during floods, they would get out of the farm ponds and into natural waterways, and they've been moving on their own ever since.
Back to that original barrier we talked about that was built in 2002, it was called a demonstration barrier. Is it still working?
Yes, it is.
And there have been three other barriers installed since. Why do we need yet another?
Well, they've been improving as they go along. So the first one was just an attempt to try to use electricity to stop fish. And they found ways to improve it, to increase the strength and to get better distribution of electricity across the channel. So they added others, and then they wanted the ability to have a backup so that there's always be at least one electrical barrier on.
So we've got four of these barriers. They do different things. What kind of devices besides electricity do they use to stop the Asian carp?
Well, right now, that's it, and that's why Brandon Road is so important, because it brings us the ability to bring other technologies into play.
Right. We should say Brandon Road is the one the Corps of Engineers just recently recommended. How much money have we spent on erecting these barriers so far?
It's tens of millions of dollars that have gone into building these electrical barriers and maintaining them.
And so why is another one, this fourth one, needed?
Well, the main thing that we need at Brandon Road, and I assume that's what you're referring to.
Yes, the Brandon Road lock and dam.
Yes, yeah. is the additional technologies that we use there. So I don't think it's so much another electrical barrier is important as it is these other technologies.
Now, this was originally estimated to cost $275 million. We're now at a price tag of $778 million. Why has that price tag nearly tripled?
That's a good question. The Corps of Engineers revised their estimates. They have some ways that they try to make sure that they don't have cost overruns, so they have techniques that they use to make a larger estimate. So they added in basically a factor of safety in their cost, and it dramatically increased the dollar figure.
Yeah, that's quite a contingency plan. There are a good number of people who argue that that man-made canal that connects the Illinois River to Lake Michigan should simply just be closed. That might cost a lot less than $778 million and would be a more concrete barrier to Asian carp invasion of the Great Lakes. Why is that not an option?
Well, that's something that was actually litigated a few years ago, and it lost in court. And the reason it lost is that there's a lot of interest on the part of commerce to have the navigation maintained. So that if you're going to keep barges moving, the commerce moving in navigation, you've got to keep the canal open. So we need to find ways of stopping the invasive species while still allowing navigation.
Well, everyone seems to be concentrating on that canal near Chicago. It appears there are Asian carp in the Maumee River, which flows into Lake Erie. Could we end up building this additional barrier on the Illinois River system only to find Asian carp have come through the back door at Toledo?
It's really important to make sure that we're talking about which fish. And so the grass carp are the ones near Toledo, and they're a threat for Lake Erie, and work is being done to try to stop them. The two fish that are the biggest threat right now in the Chicago area are the bighead and the silver carp.
So what more needs to be done before this barrier is actually under construction, and how long that will that take?
Well, the Corps in their recent release said that the earliest it could start would be in October of 2022, and the construction would stretch out until about April of 2028. So we still have a long ways to go, even if it's approved right away by Congress.
Yeah, that's a big budget item. Do you think that we have enough Great Lakes contingency in Congress to make sure that that gets through?
I hope so.
David Hamilton is Policy Director for the Nature Conservancy's Great Lakes Project. We've been talking about the history of Asian carp barriers, including the recently recommended one, which would be built near Joliet, Illinois, in an effort to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes. Thanks for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, there's a new hiking and biking trail in the works in western Michigan that organizers think could be a national attraction. We'll tell you more right after the break. You're listening to Stateside. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Well, it's time to check out what's on offer from professional theater companies around the state. And, of course, David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us. Hi there.
Hi, Lester. I hope you had a good long weekend.
Yep. Well, what do you got for us?
So the first show that I want to discuss is a very fun musical called Head Over Heels, which is playing at the Ringwald in Ferndale. This is a show that recently ran off Broadway. Lester, you like the music of the Go-Go's?
Well, they're okay, but I'm actually more of a Bangles fan. Why do you ask?
Well, this is a play of sheer foolishness. In that it uses the music of the 80s girl band, the Go-Go's, against a book that is a Renaissance pastoral romance. Jeff Witte, who wrote Avenue Q, also wrote this play. So that might give you a flavor of the comedy. Plus, there's a bit of cross-dressing and switched identities. So a little bit of Shakespeare, a little bit of Camelot, and some definite Go-Go music. Let's hear it.
The beat has ordered our lives.
Gift from the gods of their truth is a sign.
The beat heats our grapes and turns them to wine.
It threshes our wheat and gives us to dine.
We heed its rhythm and follow its form.
It keeps us in line and dictates the norm.
Our nation made strong by brilliant design.
Arcadians swear
our beat is divine.
And that plays through June 10th at the Ringwald in Ferndale.
What else you got for us?
Also a good time, but much different, is a straight play that I saw this past week at Open Book Theater in Trenton. They're doing Sam Shepard's Fool for Love. This is one of Shepard's kind of what I call a claustrophobic passion play. It's about a couple with a past and some kind of a present that I'm not going to do a spoiler. It's kind of an interesting twist in the story. But it all takes place in this residential motel room where the female protagonist, played by Krista Schaefer Eubank, lives. She and her love interest, Eddie, have a secret. And then her date walks in and becomes part of the unfolding of what that secret is. It's a good taut production of this play, which was also made into a movie. And that's at Open Book Theater in Trenton. Plays through June 15th.
So let's go to Ann Arbor. There's a new play making its Michigan premiere at Theater Nova. What can you tell us about Kill Move Paradise?
Yeah, so this is written by a playwright, James I. James. I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing that right. This play tells the story of four African-American men who find themselves in a sort of cosmic waiting room in the afterlife, trying to make sense of their lives that are now over. I haven't seen the play yet. I'll see it this week. The writing is very good because I've read the play. The casting is also terrific, and a few of the best young actors that we have in Michigan.
So what does that play?
So it opened this past weekend. I will see it this coming week, but that'll run well into June.
And for our last one, we go to the Tipping Point in Northville.
Yeah, they're opening a play called Funny Man. This is a period play set in 1959. The main character is played by Wayne David Parker, who's a terrific Michigan actor. He sees his career as a comedian declining. He's kind of an old-time kind of vaudevillian comedian. Think like Henny Youngman, for people who remember Henny Youngman. But the times are changing, you know, with experimental theater coming on in the dawn of the 60s and things like that. And so he starts facing up to his relationships as something other than Mr. Punchline. And it's interesting. I talked to the artistic director, James Cool, at the Tipping Point, and there's actually a more modern-day comedian that was kind of his motivation for selecting the play.
For me, when I first read the play, I couldn't help but think of Robin Williams and the great heart and soul and human being as a public figure that he was, that we sort of missed the tragedy that was kind of brewing underneath. And I think that this play has a lot of resonances with him and his journey, but it also very much follows the career of Bert Lahr, who was the actor who played the Cowardly Lion. So there's a number of parallels, I think, with both of those. But the universal thing with this particular play, I think, has a lot to do with the public face that we put on, that smile that we put on while we're dealing with some very difficult things or very human things in private.
So that's Funny Man at Tipping Point. That opens June 1st and runs into early July.
Now, you can get the details of all these productions and more. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, good to see you. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Lester.
There soon might be a new hiking and biking trail in Michigan. It's to be a 47-mile-long trail called The Dragon. Scott Faulkner is the fundraising coordinator for the Dragon Trail development. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester. We appreciate it.
So why are we calling it The Dragon?
Well, interestingly enough, we are fortunate to find that the actual reservoir, which is the Hardy Dam Reservoir, is in the shape of a Chinese dragon. And as we were planning this over the last 8 years or so, we noticed the anomaly on the map, and the name kind of stuck, and it's been with us ever since.
Tell us where this is at. What county, what area of the state?
It stretches across two counties. It sort of underscores the large scale of the project in Newaygo County and Mecosta County, Michigan. We're central Michigan. In it is our largest river system in the state of Michigan, the Muskegon River. And there are several dams on the Muskegon. The Hardy Dam, being the third largest earthen dam in the world, is the one that forms the Hardy Dam Reservoir, and that is the Dragon.
So what's going to be special or different about this trail versus any other trail in Michigan?
One of them is it's very pristine. The area surrounding the Dragon is entirely undeveloped. The only thing that's around it are a few campgrounds and such. And it's going to stay that way because the territory is owned by Consumers Energy, and so there won't be thousands of residents developed around this body of water. So it's very natural. That's one of them. The other is it's a loop trail. It's a 47-mile long loop trail with water in the middle. So that makes it a very unique asset, not just in Michigan, but in the North American continent. Perhaps nowhere else on Earth are you going to find a trail with those kinds of specifications, as well as the opportunity to go through a multitude of really beautiful and natural Michigan ecosystems that have remained and will remain undisturbed.
Are you going to be able to see the reservoir most of the time while you're on the trail?
For much of the time, I'm going to say 80%+. There's a fine balance, Lester, of protecting the environment, and part of that is staying back away from the embankment to prevent erosion.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it's a massive body of water, and much of the trail is close to the reservoir to maximize the views. Plus, there's an additional 13 scenic overlooks that allow folks that are in a more leisurely way, they're not trying to bike all the way through the whole thing, but to go out and really spend some time and overlooking the treasure of the water that's down below.
So do you still need some permits or approval or anything to get this going?
Well, we're down to one thing, and that is the blessing of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC
yeah.
which manages all the properties in and around hydroelectric dams. We have been working with them very conscientiously for about the last 5 years. Have gone through several iterations of things that they have asked us for. Of course, extremely important, the environmental impact surveys, the economic impact, environmental stewardship, health and wellness, lots and lots of requirements from FERC. Each and every time, we have hired world-class talent to help us answer those questions correctly. So we feel confident that FERC approval is imminent, and we can't wait to get that phone call.
And when would construction start after you get the phone call?
Immediately.
What kind of surface will this trail be?
It'll be a natural surface trail that uses most of the dirt and other materials that are found on the trail itself. So the idea is you use the natural products in and around the trail system itself. You slope it appropriately so that water doesn't stand on it, and that prevents future erosion from happening. It'll vary between 2 and 4 feet wide, and it'll be optimized for a non-motorized use. So mountain biking, yes. Hiking and running, yes. Horses, no. And motors, no. So those are sort of the restrictions around it, but that's also designed to help preserve the experience of being on the Dragon.
And pending the FERC approval, you think the trail will be open next year, later this year?
No. It will take 3 seasons to construct.
Ah.
So if we are able to start this year, we'll be finished with it in 2021. We're going to start doing the easiest parts we can this year to get as far as we can. But there will be 3 suspension bridges and many, many hundreds of yards of elevated walkways over any kind of sensitive environmental areas. Those are going to be postponed till the next season and then also into the following year if need be.
We've been talking about the Dragon Trail. Scott Faulkner is the fundraising coordinator for the 47-mile-long trail. Thanks very much for telling us about it.
Lester, thank you for your time.
In the 1960s, a group of children in Ypsilanti attended what's called the Perry Preschool Program.
Ready? What's the sound?
Wah, wah, wah. Wah. Yeah. Yeah. Ah. 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 Good.
They'll say it nice and big. Good. What's the sound?
E.
E. This sound.
Yeah.
That was audio from a documentary made back in the early 1970s about the Perry Preschool Program. 3- and 4-year-olds went to the school for half a day. Those kids and a control group have been the subject of periodic follow-up studies. The latest research comes out of the University of Chicago. Allison Belos is the executive director for the Center for Economics of Human Development there. Welcome to the program.
Hello, how are you?
So let's start with the basics. For those who are not familiar with the Ypsilanti Perry Preschool Project, tell us what it involved.
Sure. The Perry Preschool Program was a program in the 1960s, as you said, just outside of Ypsilanti. And it was an experimentally designed study, which was randomized and now long-term follow-up, which is what we're talking about today. And what they did is they took a group of disadvantaged by a low IQ and low income, those at risk of failing school. They took half and put them into the Perry Elementary School for this enriched preschool program, and the other half into a control group who didn't receive those enriched environments.
How many kids were involved altogether?
There was 128 at the beginning, and 123 we would consider actually in the study.
So there are critics who say the sample size is too small to draw conclusions for all kids. How valid is that criticism?
We understand that criticism. However, we would think that it's not valid. So the particular study we're talking about today, as well as over the decades, we have been working with the HiSCOPE team down there, and it's Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman. So he's not an advocate. He's an economist. He's just looking at what are effective policies to increase skills and promote opportunity. So he's looking at the very worst-case scenarios on how to analyze this sample. And so we've developed really rigorous statistical tools, and the findings that we find still hold.
Well, let's talk about this latest research. These Perry preschool students are now in their 50s. Throughout life, they've done better in life than the kids in the control group. Now your research indicates there's spillover into the next generation. In what ways?
That's right. So we were really excited to find these intergenerational effects. They would be unexpected. So what we did, now these participants, they have kids. The mean age is 28. And we asked them about their kids. And what we find is that they are less likely to have been suspended from school and more likely to graduate from high school and more likely to be employed full time.
Why?
So one of the things that we find is that these children were three times more likely to grow up in a two-parent household. And when we look at male children of male participants, they were actually 15 times more likely to grow up in a two-parent household. So those original first-generation preschool participants, there was, over their life, more positive outcomes. They were also had better health, more likely to graduate high school, go to college, be gainfully employed, less likely to be in prison or participate in crime. So these were more stable households and well-resourced households that these children grew up in.
So what did these kids who went to Perry Preschool learn that had that kind of effect on their lives?
So the Perry Preschool program was an enriched preschool program. These were really thoughtful teachers that were really focused on the child development. And also a unique part of the program is that there was home visiting included. So the teachers went once a week and worked with the families and with the parent. And so what you're doing is you're empowering the parent to understand the role that they play in their children's lives and effectively they're a teacher. So when the preschool program ends, the child, of course, is still living in that same household with their parents. So we think we can't conclude anything with causality, but we think that that is the effective channel.
And I guess they even had an impact on their siblings.
Indeed. So the siblings of the first generation, they did not go to Perry Preschool. It's their brothers and sisters who went to Perry Preschool. So the fact that we find similarly positive effects on health, employment, and crime and such goes to show that improving the households does indeed translate.
In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer wants to have universal preschool for all four-year-olds in the state before her first term is up. Your research suggests that might not be the best approach. Why?
Well, again, from an economic perspective, we're looking at equitable and efficient policies. So we do support universal access to programs. We know that early childhood quality early childhood programs are important for all children. We would just say from a policy perspective where the dollars are not unlimited, that it's more effective when you target the disadvantaged who might otherwise not have access to these programs. And another thing that's important is that the policies would incentivize quality. So sometimes when you're doing universal, then the quality doesn't hold across the whole state or whole county. So we would want to make sure that these are quality programs that everyone has access to.
The Perry Preschool program is very well known. It's been very well researched over the years. Why do you think it's not become a standard part of how we help educate disadvantaged children?
Well, in some ways, actually, it is. If you went to the Perry Preschool program and you're looking at a classroom today, it's not clear that quality means something different. You're still working with the children. What is different is that you're packaging it along with home visiting components. So we do know that early childhood programs, as they're rolled out today, are very compartmentalized. There might be home visiting that comes from a Department of Public Health. There's the preschool, which may be tied to public schools. It may be offered through churches. So we do think that it's the bundling that's important.
And that's the missing ingredient, it sounds like.
It can be. Not everywhere. There are a lot of places that are doing a wonderful job.
At what point will we stop studying these students of Perry Preschool?
Well, unfortunately, people don't live forever, so there is that. We hope to continue them over continued parts of their life. We are analyzing other studies as well that are younger, and this evidence that we see is across different studies, different communities, different populations, even across the world, and these effects are still holding where we're seeing positive effects. And now that we know that the positive effects go to the next generation, we'll continue to study that.
Allison Belos is the Executive Director for the Center of Economics of Human Development at the University of Chicago. Thanks very much for telling us about your research.
Thank you, Lester.
Still to come, most Michiganders believe we need to do something about the roads, but many don't trust our state and local governments to spend the money properly. That's from a new survey from the Center for Michigan. We'll learn more about what voters think of the roads after the break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham and for Cynthia Canty. The short film Inhuman starts with a classic trope of high school movies. The not as pretty, not so popular girl turns out to be a lot more. In this case, something a lot more strange. The film premiered last week at the Cannes Film Festival Short Film Corner. University of Michigan student Haley Tibbenham wrote and directed Inhuman, and she joins us now. Haley, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How did you come up with the idea for Inhuman?
So I was taking spring classes at the University of Michigan. I was taking a creative writing course with a playwriting element. It was basically just a prompt to write a scene between two characters. And if you've seen the movie, the final beach scene is what I came up with, a very early draft of it. And as soon as I wrote that scene, I knew I really loved these characters. I loved this story. And I thought there was something there. So I immediately told my teacher, I said, I think I want to make a short film out of this. I'd always been interested in film, but it was sort of a foreign medium. I'm a performer and a writer, but had never done any sort of film work before. So I said, I want to do this. She connected me with the right people to talk to over the next summer months. I basically just wrote many, many drafts, came up with one I was pretty happy with by the end of August. I sent it to my friends who are filmmakers at the university. They immediately responded saying that they loved it and they wanted to work on this project. So it all began happening very quickly. We just dove deep.
Sounds like it. The main character, Alice, is played by you. Alice is surrounded by high school friends who fail to appreciate who she is because she doesn't fit their image of beauty. In fact, they're just plain insulting and obsessed about how to improve Alice. What are you trying to show your audience?
I'm trying to show my audience like a mix of experiences I've had heightened in this sort of soapy high school world that I, you know, was sort of obsessed with as a kid. I really enjoyed shows like that, and I wanted to incorporate them into this story. And then I think it's sort of a reflection of a lot of the conversations that people have in their daily lives as young people. There's a lot of scrutiny around body image, and there is this raging debate about, you know, self-love and self-acceptance.
I'm fat, and I'm supposed to be constantly ashamed of it. Heaven forbid I be anything less than invisible. I will never understand what it means to be beautiful or desirable or loved.
And I wanted to show what that can feel like when it's directed at you and the sort of toll that it can take on a person.
I want to talk about the title because, as I took it, it could be the title "Inhuman" could be talking about the Friends or, you know, the other part, the spoiler part. What does "Inhuman" mean?
So "Inhuman" is definitely a double entendre. As I was looking up, you know, different titles for the film, I was sort of struck by this word because it has synonyms that mean extraordinary and wonderful and like impossibly great. And then there's other synonyms that mean like horrible and terrifying and all of these really dark words. And I think that kind of perfectly sums up the duality that happens in this film.
So it turns out that Alice is inhuman. In what way?
Mm-hmm. Alice is actually a vampire. So the kind of setup to this film is that Alice is this seemingly jaded and insecure teenage girl. But in fact, this like sort of cover, I like to call it, or this veil of insecurity is just hiding the fact that she is actually a vampire.
You look the exact same as when you moved here 2 years ago. You refuse to have your picture taken.
So what?
You avoid mirrors like the plague.
And?
You don't go out in the sun, and I've never seen you eat.
Most of the kids at her school are too self-obsessed and shallow to see that, but through this sort of budding romance with a boy in her class, Alice gets found out.
What was it like to make your first film?
It was very overwhelming. I was talking to my family a few weeks ago, and I just sort of was thinking that I maybe would not have done this if I had known how much work it was going to be beforehand. That sounds bad when I say it, but it was an incredible amount of work and it happened very quickly and I had no choice but to go all in. I knew that I wanted to learn something from this process and that this was the story I wanted to tell in this moment. And lucky for me, I had an incredible team of my friends, my peers, my professors, my family, who just supported me through this whole thing and continue to be the best people ever. So, yeah, I had them, and then I just went for it.
What went through your mind when you got the invitation to show your film at the Cannes Film Festival Short Film Corner?
It was a pretty exciting morning. I got the email and immediately thought it was spam or some sort of sick joke.
A prince from Nigeria or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I immediately called my mom, I called my team, and it was just the most exciting validation of all of this hard work we had done. You don't make films for other people, I think. You make them for yourself. And for me, I wanted to learn about filmmaking, and that was my goal here. But this was just like the cherry on top of everything to know that it was recognized. So yeah, it was very humbling. I will mention that here at the festival, there is a brochure called World of Shorts, and Inhuman was actually featured in their Short Film Corner highlight section. So that was kind of a cool thing that I didn't know about until we got to the festival.
Will we be able to see the film somewhere online?
So the film has to stay private for now because of festival screenings. They need to like maintain the premiere status, but you will be able to see Inhuman at various festivals throughout the next year or so. And then after that, we plan on putting it online. So hopefully within the next year, it'll be public for everyone to see.
So your very first film is getting this level of attention. Do you have another project in mind?
Right now, I am working on several different projects. I have a big senior thesis coming up at the University of Michigan School of Music.
Well, you got time to make a film then, right?
Yeah. So I'm bouncing some ideas off of people right now. I don't have any certain project locked down at this moment. But yeah, I'm just trying to explore and see what I can come up with next. Yeah. So I will be waiting just like everyone else.
Well, Haley, again, congratulations. That's quite an honor.
Thank you so much.
Haley Tibbenham is a student at the University of Michigan School of Music, Theater, and Dance. Her short film, Inhuman, premiered at the Cannes Film Festival Short Film Corner last week. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Most Michigan citizens think the roads are bad, they ought to be fixed, but there's little agreement about how to find the money to fix the roads. Those are the general findings of a survey of Michigan voters compiled by the Center for Michigan. A report titled Fixing Michigan's Road Mess, An Unclear Path is being released today, and joining us to talk about those results is the Public Engagement Director for the Center for Michigan, Ali Schmidt. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having us today.
All right, first, for those of us not familiar, tell us what is the Center for Michigan?
So the Center for Michigan is a nonpartisan, nonprofit think and do tank. We host statewide public engagement campaigns to identify what residents want of our state leaders and then amplify those views straight to Lansing. We've been doing this for about 10 years, and we also publish Bridge magazine.
We're familiar with Bridge. Voters seem mostly agreed that Michigan's roads are in poor or terrible condition. What did the survey show?
Absolutely. There is certainly a mandate that the roads are getting worse and that people want action. Three of every four Michigan residents said the roads were in poor or terrible condition, and two-thirds said that the road conditions have been getting worse. Now, Michigan residents do have experts on their side in this opinion. According to the Michigan Department of Transportation, the roads have been getting worse since 2015, and the American Society of Civil Engineers gives our roads a D-.
I was surprised to see that there are people in Michigan who think the roads are great.
There was 1% of people that thought their roads were great. I'm not quite sure where they're driving, but I would love to take a trip with them.
So you mentioned that the MDT, the Department of Transportation, says it's getting worse. How did the respondents of your polls feel about whether roads are getting worse or not?
Yeah, so two-thirds of Michigan residents said that they were getting worse and that the state should probably increase funding to make that trend reverse. It is something that does get more expensive the longer we kick the can down the road because road decrease is exponential.
Which is something that Governor Snyder said several years ago. In fact, he and other experts have said we need to increase spending by about $2.5 billion a year to get the roads and bridges fixed and keep them fixed. What's your polling show about what people think is enough money?
Yes. So people thought that we should at least be spending $1 billion more a year. 3/4 of Michigan residents said that we should spend at least $1 billion more. People were a little gun shy about going straight for that $2.5 billion. Only a small subsection of respondents said that we should foot that full package.
So even at $1 billion, I'm wondering how respondents felt we should raise those additional funds to fix those roads at $1 billion a year.
So that is where the consistency drops off. We did not find a groundswell of public support for any of the ideas that state leaders or policymakers are currently discussing. We asked about ideas such as the gas tax, such as Governor Whitmer has suggested, diverting sales tax from gasoline to schools, such as Speaker Chatfield's recommended, and no one got higher than a 64% disapproval rate.
Right. So, in fact, that was cutting state government spending, 33% in favor, by far the most favored approach, although cutting state government spending by $1 billion is a pretty significant cut. You talked about opposition. It looks like gas tax. 74% of the respondents said, nah, let's not do this with a gas tax. Exactly how do they think we're going to raise that $1 billion besides cutting government spending?
Well, that's where the poll got really interesting. We did a before and after approach to ask residents, looking at these policies without any background information, what do you think the best idea would be? And as you said, cutting government spending was the most popular one the first time around. After we gave people pros and cons for all of those options, the percentage of people that wanted to cut government spending decreased and the percentage of people that picked a tax increased. However, when we gave them those ideas one-on-one, is this a good idea or a bad idea? Every single one of them was considered a bad idea. So as you said, the gas tax got a 74% disapproval rate. But when you looked at increasing the vehicle registration fee or diverting sales tax from gasoline, those were also 76 and 75% disapproval rate. So there isn't really any consensus about exactly where the money should come from.
Except for like a wait and see approach, which I saw was, again, 64% against, but that was the most popular idea. Let's just see what things happen.
Yeah. So it was interesting when we had our regional conversations with people. People were very opposed to that verbally, but when we looked at the numbers, some people thought we should wait and see what happens with the funding that was implemented in 2015. People don't always seem to understand that $2.5 billion that it was recommended by the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission was recommended even after that funding was increased.
What's to say about Governor Gretchen Whitmer's plan? She wants a fuel tax increase.
Yeah, so that did not poll particularly well. We found that 74% of Michigan residents said that was a bad idea. Granted, we did not poll on her gas tax policy specifically with the 45 cents, but a general gas tax did not poll very well.
We're talking with Allie Schmidt with the Center for Michigan, which has been surveying Michigan voters about fixing the roads. You asked an interesting question, and that was how much voters were personally willing to pay out of pocket to fix the roads each year. What did they say?
The majority of Michigan residents were willing to pay a little bit more every year. Just over half were willing to pay $100 or more a year. The experts estimate that the average Michigan resident would need to pay $300 more a year to reach that $2.5 billion recommended by experts. And only 7% of Michigan residents said that they were willing to pay $300 more a year.
So residents aren't even willing to pay enough to meet that $1 billion a year that the majority said that they would be interested in.
It would be a little bit tricky. When we were talking to people around the state, we heard a lot of misgivings that if the state was given additional funding, that it would be spent properly. People were concerned that the roads aren't being built very well in the first place or that the money wouldn't be distributed. So there's a lot of hesitancy to give the government extra money or additional money if they aren't sure it's going to be spent where they say it is.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Did they say why they felt that way, that they didn't trust the government to use the money properly?
I think there's a lot of issues regarding public trust across the state. The Center for Michigan did a public engagement campaign in 2016 and found on public trust, and we found that public trust in government was at historic lows. So there is not a lot of trust in government in general, as well as a lack of transparency at the state level. The Center for Public Integrity rates Michigan state government 50 out of 50 of all 50 states in terms of transparency. So there is a lot of concern that the money would come in and not be spent, and we wouldn't ever know how it was spent.
So this affects state highways, of course, but it also affects local governments. What do local officials think about the road situation, and do they have any solutions?
There was a bit of a call to look at Act 51, that it was passed in the 1950s and that governs how our state funding for roads is distributed. It has been updated several times since then, but it puts 39% of the funding that is raised across the state goes to MDOT, and then the rest of that is distributed across our cities, villages, and counties, which all take care of their own roads. The local roads, such as cities and villages, counties, do receive a lower rating in terms of quality than the state roads. And so local officials we talked to said they feel they aren't getting enough funding.
And I talked to a county executive not too long ago who said even the formula is messed up because these lane miles that they calculate don't take into account that some of their lanes might be three lanes wide. Is that much of a problem, or is that something that local officials brought up?
Yeah, that is something that people think that we should re-examine, or that's what we heard from officials when we were on the roads. As you said, they look at lane miles, not center lane miles, so you're going to get the same amount of money for a three-lane road as you would for a one-lane road, which is not very helpful sometimes.
Given the mood of the voters, where does Michigan go from here?
I think that the auto insurance moves that are happening at the Capitol are probably going to give people hope that the bipartisan solutions are possible. Again, when we were on the road last year, we heard from residents during our Truth Tour that fixing bipartisanship was the number thing that they wanted in Lansing. So perhaps this would give our legislature an opportunity to find another bipartisan solution.
So we've been hearing some rumors that maybe we'll pass a budget and then maybe we'll look at the roads, things like that. I know this was done a year ago, so we didn't know that then, or the people didn't know that then. But do they see any way to find a solution that will not take $300 out of their pocket each year and still fix the roads the way they think they ought to be fixed?
Mm-hmm. So we did this poll in April, not a year ago.
Okay.
But there was certainly, again, some hope for that bipartisanship where perhaps we could cut from some areas and raise taxes in a different area. So do a blended model of reappropriation and increased taxation.
So we hear from politicians a lot about waste, fraud, and abuse. Is that what the people were saying as well? That's where we can recapture some of this money to put into roads?
I don't think we met many people that thought they could find the full $2.5 billion in the state budget in wasteful spending. The state budget's $52 billion, so the $2.5 is a large chunk of it. But there are, certainly are Michiganders that think we could look in the budget and help with the road situation by moving money we already have.
Allie Schmidt is the Public Engagement Director for the Center for Michigan. Thanks for telling us about your polling of voters' thoughts on fixing the roads.
Thank you again for inviting us in. It's been great to be here.
Join us for tomorrow when we'll continue the discussion about Michigan's roads and how to pay for them with the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation. Plus, we'll look at the proposed changes to auto insurance and how they might help low-income residents. That and more tomorrow on Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty, thanks for listening today.